days this way, sitting around, talking, laughing, and loving each other again. One night, I dream about Cave. She is beautiful, young, and exuberant. My dream starts peacefully. I am somewhere alone with her. We are talking, walking. I reach out to her, but stop, because her appearance is changing. In front of my eyes, as she continues to talk, she grows thinner and thinner. Her skin becomes yellowish, aged, and hangs loose from her bones. Then the skin on her face begins to melt, becoming transparent, exposing the outlines of her large eye sockets and the skeletal bones behind them. I want to run away, but I also want to stay. Her lips are still moving, and she says, "I'm all right. I am not as you see me." I love her, and want so much to be with her, to find out where she is now so that I can meet her. I do not understand what she is saying, and I scream myself awake. Determined to live, the next morning I force myself to walk the hospital grounds looking for food to steal, to fill my stomach. I stay in the infirmary for as long as I can, and with the sugar cubes and food and rest from work, my body gradually grows stronger. After 1 week, the infirmary becomes overcrowded, and the nurses force us to leave. First, they kick out Meng, then Keem, then me. I cry, whine, and lie, but in the end, I am forced to leave. Walking away, I break my farewell rule and look back to see Ma, Chu, and Gek crying and standing in the doorway. It was a mistake to turn around. My body aches to run back to them, to hold on to them. Expanding my lungs with air, I straighten my shoulders and march away firmly, wondering when I will see them again. The walls crumble. November 1978. Another 6 months has passed since our family reunion at the infirmary. Back at the camp, my life continues as before, and with another increase in food rations, I become still stronger. We no longer work in the fields, but spend the hours learning to fight in combat, as rumors spread that Yuans have invaded our borders. During the day, we train with the few sickles, hoes, knives, stakes, and guns that are available in the camp. Most of the training is repetitive, but Mei Bong insists that only when the movements become automatic will we be able to fight well. In the evening, after our meal, we gather brush and sticks to build a fence around our camp. Early one morning, I wake up with dread and panic. My stomach knots, and I am drenched with sweat. I tell myself it is nothing, just nerves. I convince myself that I get nervous easily. After washing my face, I join the other kids in training. Mei Bong takes her old clothes and stuffs them with leaves and straw to make dummies. For the heads, she stuffs her red checkered scarf with straw. She calls them her Yuan dummies and hangs them on trees in the field. After another long report about the evil of the Yuans, she lines us up single file across from the dummies. With a 6-inch knife in my hand, I stand at attention in front of the line. Panting like an animal, with my legs shaking and my hand gripping the knife, I attack at Mei Bong's cue. Charging at my dummy, I yell, "Die! Die!" Though I focus on its head, I am only tall enough to thrust my knife into its stomach. The next morning, I wake up in great agony. My head throbs, my stomach hurts, and my chest constricts, as if someone is sitting on it. I wrap my arms around my stomach, wanting to scream to the world. Something hurts inside me. Rage erupts in my body, making me jump and run out of the hut. I don't understand the electricity in my body, this panic, this sadness, hatred, emotions that manifest into physical pains. I have to see Ma. It is dangerous to travel without permission, but I do not care. I have to go to her. I know I cannot leave through the front gate. If the girls see me, they will tell on me. I walk around the hut and search for a part of the fence where I can make my escape. I see a loosely built part where the stakes are far apart and the bushes sparse. Making sure no one can see me, I drop to my knees. Quickly, I part the prickly bushes, get on all fours, and crawl through. I walk in the hot sun without food or water. Though my throat begs for water and my feet crave to stop, I push on. My heart races as images of Ma and Gek flash before me. Their faces are long, their mouths turned down, their eyes glisten with tears. They sit at the hut in Roleep, calling out to me, as if they are trying to tell me something. I know why they are calling out to me, but I cannot accept it. I know. My thought turns to Pa, and I remember how he told me I had extrasensory perception. Even as young as I am, I have always felt as if I live 80% of my life in déjà vu. In Phnom Penh, many times I knew who was on the other line, even before Pa picked up the phone. Walking in the streets with Pa or eating noodles with Ma at the shops, I would sense that we'd run into a certain person, and we would. In Roleep, I had a dream that a certain house would catch on fire, and it did. Pa said it is a power, and though I did not fear it then, I fear it now. The minutes turn into hours until I reach Roleep. It is mid-morning. The village is quiet. When I enter the village, I run to Ma's hut. Ma! I call out frantically. Ma! Gek! No one replies. Ma! I run as fast as I can into the garden. Ma and Gek are not there. Tears blur my vision as I run back to her hut. Everything is still there. Their wooden rice bowls and spoons, the small pile of clothes. Ma! I scream, my voice hoarse. They are not here, a voice answers. A young woman stands in the doorway of the next hut. She is new. I do not recognize her. They left yesterday. My baby is sick, so I did not go to work. I saw them leave. Where did they go? I don't know. They went with soldiers, the woman says quietly, and looks away. She stares into the distance, refusing to look back at me. We both know what it means when the soldiers come to the village and take someone with them. Part of me cannot believe what the woman says, but the other knows it is true. Yesterday I could not explain the mental anxiety and physical pains I woke up with. Now I know it was Ma and Gek telling me about the soldiers. Ma, where are you? Ma, you can't do this to me! I scream into the empty hut. They cannot have survived 3 years of starvation and the loss of Cave and Pa only to be taken now. The last time I saw her, she was doing okay without Pa. I believed she was going to make it. She fought so hard to live. She cannot be gone. Poor little Gek. She never got anything good out of life. At the sound of her baby's cries, the woman goes into her hut. Inside, the woman hums her baby back to sleep. A memory of Ma singing me to sleep in Phnom Penh flashes before me. I cannot be strong anymore. My wall crumbles and collapses on top of me. Tears run uncontrollably down my face. My chest compresses. My insides gnaw at me, eating away at my sanity. I have to run away. I have to leave. Somehow my legs take over and carry me away from the village. Ma! Gek! I whisper to them. Their faces flood my consciousness. My mind races, remembering the time I stole rice from the container, out of their mouths. She never knew how it felt not to be hungry. My mind will not leave me alone. My body goes weak when I wonder which one the soldiers killed first. My mind projects pictures of the two of them together. I see them marched slowly in a long line of 20 people, collected from other villages in the province. A group of 5 or 6 Khmer Rouge soldiers walk on either side of the villagers. The soldiers' rifles point at the prisoners. The rain 3 days before has left the field wet and slippery with mud, making it difficult for the villagers to keep their balance. Besides the grunts, moans, and whimpers of the villagers, all is quiet. Both the soldiers and the villagers have on black pajama clothes and red and white checkered scarves with mud stains on their bottoms and knees. The men walk with their fingers locked behind their head. Sweat drips from their forehead and stings their eyes, but they dare not unlock their hands to wipe them. The women, children, and old villagers are allowed to use their arms to balance while they work their way on the uneven ground. Whatever their history, whatever their past, They are marching now because the Angkar branded them traitors to the government. Trailing along at the end of the line, Ma carries Gek on her back. Ma cries softly, her body tense with fear and her hands holding on to Gek. She feels Gek bounce slightly on her back as she catches her balance and prevents herself from a fall in the mud. Biting her lips, she thinks of Pa, and wonders if he was this afraid when they took him away. She shakes her head, not allowing herself to think of him as being dead. Parts of her will always believe he is alive somewhere. It has been almost 2 years, and still she misses him every minute of the waking hour. In her dreams, he is so real that she wakes up hurting more than the day before. Sometimes, while she pulled weeds from the vegetable gardens, her mind wandered to their first meeting by the river, when she first caught his eye. She thought he was so handsome, but knew her parents would not approve of him. She loved him, and despite her parents' objections, she ran away and they eloped. She just wanted to be with him. Maybe she would be with him again soon. The soldiers lead them past the rice paddies, past the swaying palm trees, to a field at the edge of the village. There, away from all eyes, they make Ma kneel with the other villagers. Sinking in the cool mud, Ma and Gek cling to each other. She hugs Gek tight to her chest, as if trying to push her baby back into her belly to spare her from the pain. She slides one hand up the back of Gek's head to make sure her face is turned away from the massacre about to happen. In her arms, Gek's body shudders, and her teeth clatter near Ma's ears. She feels Gek's small hand gripping her neck, yet she is quiet. The soldiers stand before them, their rifles aiming at the group, their fingers poised on the triggers. The dark clouds move over them, casting black shadows on the soldiers. The wind blows warm air around them, but Ma is shivering. She knows there is no fighting her fate. She knows no amount of begging will allow her to escape. She wraps her arms even tighter around Gek and squeezes her eyes shut, praying while the others beg for mercy. She brings Pa's face to mind and waits. That second feels like an eternity. She fights the impulse to scream, to provoke the soldiers to just get it over with. She does not know how much longer she can be brave. The wait makes her heart begin to believe in hope. Could the soldiers have changed their minds and let them all go? She finds herself breathing faster at this thought. No, I must be strong for Gek. She must not leave this world in terror. Then Ma hears the slush of mud as a soldier moves his position. Her heart pounds as if it will rip through her chest. One soldier slings his rifle across his back and walks toward the group. Ma feels the ground beneath her become warm and wet. Glancing to her side, she sees that the man next to her has wet his pants. A soldier approaches the group. He walks straight toward her. Ma's eyes widen with hope. Her heart palpitates with fear. The soldier reaches down and grabs Gek's shoulders. The two of them scream a loud, shrill scream that echoes through the air. But the soldiers do not stop and pull Gek out of her grasp as they cling to one another, yelling to each other not to let go. The soldier tears them apart until only the tips of their fingers hold them together. Then that chain, too, is broken. All the villagers cry and beg and start to get up off their knees. Suddenly, the rattling sounds of the rifles go off, and bullets pierce through their bodies, silencing their screams. Gek runs over to Ma's slumped-over body with her face in the mud. Gek is only 6 years old, too young to understand what has just happened. She calls Ma and shakes her shoulders. She touches Ma's cheeks and ears and grabs her hair to try to lift her face out of the mud, but she is not strong enough. While rubbing her eyes, she wipes Ma's blood all over her own face. She pounds her fists on Ma's back, trying to wake her up. But Ma is gone. Holding on to Ma's head, Gek screams and screams, not stopping to take in any air. One soldier's face darkens and he raises his rifle. Seconds later, Gek, too, is silenced. Walking away from Row Leap, I am deafened by the ringing in my ears. All the stories I have heard of how the Khmer Rouge kill their victims come back to me. Tales of them tying their victims in potato sacks and throwing them in the river, and stories of their torture chambers frequently circulate among the villagers. It is said the soldiers often kill children in front of their parents to elicit confessions and names of traitors. The ringing in my ears becomes louder, making me disoriented. Ma's face appears before me. I choke as I think of the pain she feels as she watches the soldiers hurt Gek. My mind obsesses over the pictures my mind makes up of their deaths, which refuse to let go of me. Then my head feels full and heavy. Tears pour from me as I drag my body away from the village. Someone once told me that if you hit your head hard enough, you lose all your memories. I want to hit my head hard. I want to lose my memory. The pain in my heart hurts so much, it becomes physical and attacks my shoulders, back, arms, and neck like hot pins pricking at me. Only death will relieve me of it. Then, something takes over me. It is as if I am drifting away into another place, into the deepest recesses of my mind to hide from the pain. Suddenly, the world becomes hazy and blurry. It is black all around me, soothing and empty. My pain and sadness no longer feel real or personal, no longer mine, when the blackness swallows my surroundings, and me with it. When I regain some level of conscious thought, I am back at my camp, standing before Mae Bong. My hand massages my stinging cheek. I taste blood in my mouth. Mae Bong has slapped me awake. "Where have you been?" she demands, as the world comes back in focus. The girls stand around us, watching me. "I don't know," I manage to say. "I went to see..."
"And you stayed for 3 days? Don't you know the Yuans are everywhere?"
My eyes widen in disbelief. "No, I don't know where I was," I tell her honestly. Her hand lands hard across my face again. The pain makes me dizzy. I almost lose my balance.
"You won't tell me? You won't have any food tonight, and I will reduce your food ration until you do!"
She screams into my face and walks away. After she is gone, I walk to the well and pull up a pail of water. Drinking some, I pour the rest over my feet. Rubbing one foot against the other, I remove the layers of red mud to expose my small, wrinkled toes. "Ma is dead," I repeat to myself with little emotion. "Ma is dead." I have no memory of the 3 days after I left her village. In our training the next day, I charge at the Yuan dummies even before Mae Bong's cue. My skin vibrates with hate and rage. I hate the gods for hurting me. I hate Pol Pot for murdering Pa, Ma, Cave, and Gek. I stab my wooden stake high into the dummy's chest, feeling it puncture the body and hit the tree. Hard and fast, I stab it, each time envisioning not the body of a Yuan, but that of Pol Pot. Now, it is all real. Now, I no longer have to pretend to be an orphan. The Yuan Invasion, January 1979. Hugging the rifle to her chest, Mae Bong paces back and forth nervously at our nightly session.
"The Yuans have invaded our country. They are taking over our towns. These monsters are raping Khmer women and killing Khmer men. They will kill you if they catch you. You must protect yourself in any way you can. Pol Pot is all-powerful, and we can defeat the Yuans."
"Angkor! Angkor! Angkor!" we scream in unison, even though her words make no sense. While I pretend to listen, I wonder why the Khmer Rouge fears the Yuans if we can defeat them. If we can beat them, then why are they able to take over our country?
Instead of one, two girls will now guard the camp at night. You are to shoot the Yuans dead when you see them.
That night, none of us can sleep as we listen to explosions of mortars and rockets in the distance. Though we are afraid, Maybong tells us the Khmer soldiers will keep them away from us. After a few hours of shelling, all is quiet again. Then, without warning, a mortar explodes near our base, blazing the sky white like lightning. Fear runs up my spine and shoots into my heart. I scream and cover my ears with my hands just as another mortar whistles and hits our hut. The straw walls and roof burst into flame. Screaming and wailing, the girls try to escape before fire consumes the hut. The girls run and crawl to the door, their faces black from smoke and their eyes white with terror. Many are dripping blood from their arms and legs where shrapnel sliced through their skin. I jump up and head for the doorway as fire spreads everywhere. "Don't leave me! I'm hit! Help me!" a voice screams out shrilly. She is lying in a pool of blood. Propping herself up on her elbow, she begs us to help her. She is shaking and shivering. The other girls do not stop. Seeing me looking at her, she holds out a bloody hand to me. "Help me!" On her elbows, she tries to crawl to the door, but pants in frustration after a few yards. Her tears fall into her mouth. Fire spreads through the camp quickly, debris falling everywhere. "The smoke! The fire! Help me!" Her hand grabs her chest as she coughs out blood. I want to help her. I wish to help her, but I am much smaller than she. I scream and cover my ears as another mortar explodes nearby. Panicked, I turn my back on her and jump out of the hut. When the roof collapses, the girl continues to scream long, anguished cries as flames engulf the hut. All the girls head off in different directions in a desperate bid to escape the camp. In the dark, the straw walls and roofs combust into yellow and orange flames, illuminating the red faces of girls running away. On the road, I find myself crowded among thousands of people, walking amid deserted towns and villages. I have to find Chu. I am alone without her. Automatically, my body takes control of my feet and veers me in the direction of her camp. There is no time to be afraid. Her camp is dark and empty when I get there. "Chu! Chu! Chu!" I scream her name. I circle around the compound, but she is not there. I run back out into the traffic, not knowing what to do next. I don't know where to find my older brothers. All around me, the people move like a herd of cows in a stampede, yelling and crying out family members' names. "Please let them be alive," I whisper, while people bump and push me out of their way. Not knowing what to do, I walk out of the traffic and climb onto a big rock on the side of the road. Hugging my knees to my chest, I cry as the traffic rushes on ahead of me, leaving me behind. It is like the mass of humanity leaving Phnom Penh all over again, but I am alone now. I do not have Cave's arms around me protecting me, or Pa, Ma, and Gek by my side, or Khoi and Meng leading the way. I sit there hugging myself when I feel a hand grab my shoulder. It's Keem. He's alive. Chu is with him, holding on tight to his hand. "Chu!" I exclaim happily. I have never been so happy. "Come, we have to leave quickly," Keem yells and grabs my hand as we head back onto the road and into the traffic. Though we do not know where we are supposed to go, our goal is to somehow try to find our brothers. Keem is once again in charge of the family. As we walk, Keem tells us that once he heard the explosions coming from our direction, he escaped from his camp and ran here to find Chu. They were on their way to look for me. Chu and I follow Keem's lead and do as he says. He seems so much in control that I forget he is not quite 14. As other people carry their pots, pans, clothes, food, and other belongings on their backs or in their wagons, Keem carries a backpack with a few clothes in it, while Chu and I hold his hands and walk with only the clothes we are wearing. We walk through the night with the sea of people, following their route. Keem says it is safer if we keep with the crowd. Though my feet and body crave to rest, through half-open eyes I lean on Keem and totter on. Soon the sun comes out. In crimson red, golden yellow, and fiery orange, it lights up the world around us. In the field, tall elephant grass glistens with morning dew, while gray smoke floats into the sky from distant villages. The small red gravel roads are swarmed body to body with people in their black shirts and pants. The traffic does not stop and continues to move, everybody dragging their feet slower and slower. Those who cannot move any farther sit at the side of the road. Some curl up in a fetal position and sleep. Others leave the traffic to scavenge for fruits and berries a few meters from the road, all the time keeping themselves close to the traffic. The snake-like traffic pushes on with the strong, able-bodied men forming the head, and the old, young, weak, and hungry trailing behind as the tail. As soon as the first snake disappears from our view, another one comes winding along for those left behind to join. As the sun climbs higher in the sky, my stomach begins to growl. Keem spots a small grassy footpath hidden behind some bushes and veers us toward it as the traffic moves on. Walking in silence, Chu and I follow Keem's lead. After 5 minutes, Chu and I glance at each other nervously, afraid to be so far away from the traffic, but we dare not question Keem. Another 10 minutes pass. We have walked a kilometer away from the road before our path leads us to a deserted village. Alone in the village, all is quiet, except for the muffled grunts of pigs and cackles of chicken. The villagers evacuated in such a hurry that they left clothes, sandals, and scarves strewn everywhere on the ground. In the communal kitchen, smoke still rises from the ashes. Chu enters a hut and comes out with a few metal pots, aluminum bowls, and the remaining few small bags of rice and salt. I grab 3 scarves, spare black pajama clothes, and 3 light blankets. Placing them in the middle of another blanket and tying its corners together, I make a big bundle to balance on my head. In one house, a pig and 2 chickens scurry about. After a few minutes of chasing after the pig, we become tired and let it go. Even if we could catch it, we do not know how we would slaughter it, since we do not have a knife. Keem catches the 2 chickens and locks their wings behind their backs. We look around for a sharp object to slit their throats. Not finding one, Keem grabs the bird and walks over to a well. Holding the chicken by its legs, he swings it like a bat and smashes its head against the stone wall. From 10 feet away, I hear the bird's skull crack as blood sprays everywhere on the ground, splattering onto Keem's feet. The chicken's body struggles and twists, refusing to die, until Keem whacks it again, this time smashing its head. Then he does the same with the other chicken. Chu fetches water from the well and pours some over Keem's feet, rinsing the blood off. She pours the rest of the water into our new pot, while Keem rekindles the fire by adding dry leaves and branches. Chu puts the chickens in the pot, submerging them in water to boil them whole. After an hour, she takes the chickens out, and we pluck the feathers off. Then she boils them for another hour or so. When they are cooked, she pours salt on them so they will not spoil. While she prepares the chickens, my stomach growls and my mouth waters. I have not had any kind of meat in such a long time. Finally, Chu announces they are done. Keem breaks off a leg, scoops up a bowl of rice and hands it to me. He gives Chu the other leg, takes the breasts himself, and saves the rest for our trip. With our plates in front of us, we eat in silence. Slowly, I peel off the skin, which tastes tough and rubbery. I eat the rest of the chicken with joy and sadness, as I remember how Ma was beaten for trying to get some for Gek. After the meal, we pick up our bundles and walk back out to join the mob of people. Not knowing where we are going, we follow the traffic. We walk all day and stop to rest for the night along with everyone else. While others build fires, cook food, and talk, we eat our food in silence. On every side of us, men talk vehemently about the Yuan invasion and the defeat of Pol Pot's army. They spit out the evil Pol Pot's name and swear to each other they will hunt him and his officers down to avenge their suffering. Their voices grow to a feverish pitch as they recount the bodies they saw in the fields nearby their villages. Their words make me think of Mei Bong. For a year, while I was at the camp, Mei Bong told me every day the Yuans were attacking Cambodia and that the mighty Khmer Rouge army would defeat them. She was so afraid of the Yuans taking over our country that she was paranoid the Yuans would populate Cambodia, and in a few years the country would become no more than a Yuan colony. How fearful she must be now, if she is alive, that the Yuans, our enemy, have invaded Kampuchea, and as a result stopped the Khmer Rouge from killing more Cambodians. Every night she told us that a Khmer Rouge soldier could kill 20 Yuan soldiers because our soldiers are better and braver fighters. I wonder what happened to the mighty Khmer Rouge soldiers. Maybe the Khmer Rouge's power is just another one of Pol Pot's many lies. My legs hurt, and my body aches from the walk, but physical pain does not matter anymore. My mind wanders to Pa, Ma, and Gek, and I become deaf to the conversations around me. Pa cared about politics. I am too young to understand Pol Pot's strategies for creating a classless, pure agrarian society. I do not know why Pol Pot did what he did when he made us leave Phnom Penh, gave us very little food, or took Pa away from me. All I know is if the Yuans invading Kampuchea could have saved Pa, Ma, Cave, and Gek, I wished they would have come sooner. After we eat more of our chicken, Chu spreads one blanket on the grass, and I roll up the scarves to use as pillows. We have settled in the middle of an open field that sits at the edge of a forest.
"The open field," one man says, "is safe from the Yuan's crushing monster."
"Mepo," I ask a comrade uncle curiously, "what is this crushing monster?"
"You don't know?"
he asks, incredulous. I shake my head in reply.
"No one has actually seen it, but they say it is like a wild monster, and nothing can destroy it. It is part machine, part man, but very evil. It is bigger than a hut, and can shoot out flames and bombs. It has many wheels for legs and rolls across the land like thunder, destroying everything in its path. It can smash trees, rocks, metal, everything. Nothing can destroy it."
My eyes open wide as I learn of this evil machine, wondering if it is sitting in the woods waiting for us. "So it is safer for us to be in the open so we can see it approaching and run out of its way?" I ask, as my knees grow weak and my imagination creates images of the crushing monster chasing after us. "Chu, let's move into the middle of the crowd," I plead with her as I grab her hand. Keem frowns at us as we repack our bundles and get ready to move.
"It's not a monster. That man does not know what he is talking about. He is a farmer who's never left his village until now and probably has never even seen a car, so he wouldn't know what a tank looks like. It's a huge machine that a man drives like a car."
He tries to reassure us, but it does not work. "Does it roll over trees, houses, and metal? Does it destroy everything in its path?" I question him.
"Yes, but..."
"Does it shoot out fire and bombs?"
"Yes, but..."
"All right, we'll move."
Keem sighs and picks up his bags. Making our way into the maze of many thousands of people, we move to a spot in the middle of the crowd and set up for the night. "Now we won't be the first one to get crushed by the monster," I say, and Chu nods in agreement. Keem smiles and shakes his head, dropping his bags to the ground. Chu spreads out our blanket again and lies down. With her in the middle, Keem and I huddle closely on either side of her. Keem hooks the backpack through his arms, while I do the same to my bundle. We pull another blanket over us. The ground is cold, but I am warmed by Chu's body heat. All around us, people are sleeping, eating, or setting up their areas. I look over to the side and watch a family sitting together, eating their meal. It is a family of five, parents with three boys, from perhaps 5 to 10 years old. The father scoops rice and hands it over to his youngest child first, then he does the same for the others. The mother reaches over and wipes the child's nose with her fingers, then quickly wipes her hand on her skirt. While they eat, the father's eyes watch over his family and their belongings. I turn away and look at the sky, as tears roll out the corners of my eyes.
Oh, Pa, I miss you, I tell him in my head. The sky is dark and silvery. It fills with a few gray, wispy clouds and countless twinkling stars. I stare at the clouds and envision Pa's face looking down at me. Where are the angels, Pa? I ask him. All of a sudden, the clouds pull together, forming many tight balls. Quickly, these balls begin taking the shape of skulls. They hover over me, these cloud skulls, glaring at me with their invisible eyes. My breath quickens and my chest tightens, and I force my eyes to look away. I focus on my arm, and my heart races when I see grass growing out of my flesh. Like the hair on my arm, the grass pokes easily out of my skin like needles through paper, growing taller and taller. Then my flesh melts, and my skin sinks into the ground. In slow motion, my skin decomposes until there is nothing left and it mixes with the dirt, becoming Khmer Rouge topsoil. Holding my breath, I squeeze my eyes shut and pinch decomposed arm. Feeling the pain of the pinch, I open my eyes, and all is normal again. Locking my arms together across my chest, I close my eyes and try to sleep. We wake up the next morning and resume our journey once more. Since Keem and Chu have not mentioned anything about searching for Ma and Gek, I assume they know of their fate. I do not know how he and Chu found out about Ma and Gek. I dare not bring up the subject. Keem tells us we will try and make our way to Porsot City and wait for our brothers there. Keem does not tell us how long we will wait for Meng and Khoi, or how long we will be there once we reach Porsot City. I do not know why Keem assumes Khoi and Meng are still alive. Since we left Ma and went to our separate camps, we have had no way of receiving news from our older brothers. It has been more than a year now since we last saw them. As an implicit rule, we do not talk about our family. I fear that if I ask, I will make Chu and Keem sadder than they already are. Being only 8 years old, this is the only way I know to protect them. Every day we walk with the crowd, occasionally stopping in deserted villages to rummage for food. It is many days before we see the first sign of a possible end destination. My heart pounds so loudly, I am sure others can hear it, as my feet come to a complete stop. Before us walk three men dressed in green clothes with funny, round, cone-shaped hats on their heads. Their legs move in long, casual strides, and their rifles swing on their back. Humans, the traffic hums and whispers. My breath becomes short and shallow. Images of the Yuans torturing and killing their victims flash before my eyes. I have never seen a Yuan, and yet these men look remarkably human. They are the same size as our Khmer men and are similarly built, not like the Barong, with light skin and a thin nose, like I saw in Phnom Penh. The Yuans look more like Ma than many Khmers. They do not look like the devils Mae Bong said they were. The Yuans walk toward us and raise their hands in greeting. I search the ground for weapons, a staff, sharp rocks, anything I can use to fight them. All eyes focus on them as they come nearer. People gasp when in the next moment one Yuan smiles and says in broken Khmer, Chumaritpusu, which means hello. There is a refugee camp up ahead in Porsot City, he tells us, and keeps walking. The crowd smiles gratefully. I cannot believe it. The Yuans did not shoot us. They did not take the children and slice open their stomachs. They even told us where Porsot City is. At last, after 3 days on the road, we have a destination. The camp looms like a small village before me, flickering and swaying in the haze like a mirage. From afar, the many green, black, and blue plastic tents jut into the sky like thousands of anthills with black-haired people frittering in every direction. While most people sleep out in the open spaces, others are putting up makeshift tents and building huts. Next to the huts and tents, women prepare food, blowing and stoking the fires, coughing as the smoke finds their faces. Hovering above these women,
Men and children tie strings of wet clothes from trees to tents, creating giant spider webs. Beside each group of tents lie small hills of trash, rotting in the hot sun, with children playing around them, occasionally picking up a half-eaten mango, orange, or fish head, and putting it in their mouths. The Ewens are all around, weaving through the labyrinth of homes and patrolling the area with rifles on their shoulders and grenades attached to their belts. There are many of them, smiling and talking to the kids, sometimes patting them on the head. My eyes follow a certain Ewen in a green camouflage uniform as he openly approaches a young Khmer woman in black pajama clothes. He flirts with her, and I think he is barbaric. He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a box. Placing it on his palm, he extends his hand to her. Shyly, she smiles and starts to take it, only to have him grab a hold of her hand. Abruptly, she pulls her hand out of his grasp. After the brief stolen touch, he continues to talk to her. It fascinates me to see the Ewens courting girls in public, for in the Khmer culture, these things are done in secret. In the midst of the crowd, I overhear the Khmer men discussing how the Ewens are there to protect us. They say the Ewens marched into Cambodia only 3 weeks ago, on January 25th, and through their artillery power and army defeated the Khmer Rouge, sending Pol Pot and his men running into the jungles. During his entire regime, Pol Pot had been provoking the Ewens' attack by sending his men to their borders and massacring Vietnamese villages. Pol Pot viewed the Ewens as the archenemy of the Khmer people and feared the Ewens would annex their land if we did not attack them first. But Pol Pot's small, ill-equipped army could not win against the well-trained, well-equipped Ewen army. The men say that the Ewens have liberated Cambodia and saved us all from the murderous Pol Pot. Keem pulls at my arm and gestures for me to hurry as I begin to fall behind. We pass through the crowd, searching for an empty spot to make our home. I look longingly at the adults in the crowd. I want to have our own adult to take care of things, build houses, put up tents, and forage for food. I remember when we left Phnom Penh how Pa, Khoi, and Meng searched for food and took care of us. Though I was also hungry then, I was less afraid because I knew they would look after me. Gazing at the adults in the camp, I pray silently, wishing someone will ask us to join their family. But we are invisible to them. The adults look through us. They have their own families, and can't burden themselves with us. Having no success finding a home in the midst of the crowd, and with no tent for shelter, we settle under a tree at the edge of camp with a few other orphans. With our small bag of rice dwindling, Keem is as good as Pa was at rationing our food. Every morning he goes out to a nearby river and fishes, while Chu and I guard our things. Sometimes we see a jubilant Keem return with a smile on his face, and know we will eat well that night. Other times, Keem returns with drooping shoulders and a scowl on his face. With the influx of refugees pouring into the camp, the river becomes polluted and the fish gone. It becomes increasingly hard for Keem to catch fish in the shallow water. Tonight, Chu and I cook mushrooms and wild vegetables that we found in the field, and we make rice soup for dinner. But many other nights we have nothing to eat and go to bed hungry. After we eat, Chu spreads a small blanket over the grass and covers us with the other two. Huddling close to Chu, I cry silent tears for my family, my loneliness, and my constant hunger. But most of all, I cry for Keem. I cry knowing how he feels coming back each night and having to tell us there will be nothing to eat. After a week of living under the tree, the nights become cold and our stomachs too empty, so Keem asks a family camping nearby to let us live with them. With our bundles in our hands, we stand before them, our faces washed, our hair wet and smoothed over, and our manners polite and respectful. "Sorry, we cannot," the father says to us. "We can barely care for our own family." My face turns red from embarrassment and hopelessness. I do not understand their unwillingness to help us. They are adults, and adults are supposed to be able to care for children. But they don't want us. They don't want me. Nobody wants me. With our eyes downcast and shoulders slumped, we walk back to our spot under the tree, and I vow to try harder to make people like me. Though he cannot take us in, the man feels sorry for us and looks for a family to take us. He comes back with a few interested families, but no one wants to take in all three of us, and we would rather brave the cold than be separated.
The First Foster Family. January 1979.
I have found a family for you, the man tells us excitedly a week later. They have some small children and an old grandmother. They need someone to help with the children and around the house, and they are willing to take all three of you.
That afternoon, I wait with nervous anticipation to meet my new family. I wonder what they are like and what it would feel like to belong to a family again. A new family. A safe home, food to eat, someone to protect me. When finally I see their figures in the distance, I cannot believe my eyes. I squint to make sure it really is them. Opening my eyes again, I grab Chu's hand and whisper quietly to her, "It is them. It is the palm tree boy and his dad, the same people who came to my soldier training camp to collect palm sap." Chu nods and warns me to be quiet. Though appearing calm on the outside, inside I am spinning faster and faster. How can this be, I think to myself, that in this crowd of people I actually know them? The palm tree boy and his father break into big smiles when they recognize me. They seem actually happy about it. This must be fate, a good omen. Maybe things will be all right after all. I am barely able to contain my happiness.
This is no coincidence, the man exclaims. I know this little girl.
He laughs and musses my hair. My face beams with joy at the touch of his hand. I am Kim, and she is Chu, and this is Luong. Kim introduces us.
You want to come and live with us? The palm boy's father asks.
We nod.
All right, let's go home.
I look up at him, and he smiles.
Here, give me your bundle,
he says, taking it out of my hand. My eyes shine at him, and my heart floats to the clouds. Father, my mind whispers happily. Chu and Kim thank our neighbors as we leave with our new family.
I have a big family already, the father says. I have three little girls who are 1, 3, and 4, and my oldest, Poff, is 14. My wife needs help looking after the kids. My mother is old and also needs help. You girls will help care for them, cook, collect wood, and tend the garden, while Kim will go out fishing and hunting with me.
His voice is so matter-of-fact now, when it was welcoming and happy a few minutes before. The realization of our work arrangement sends chills down my spine. He is not Pa. I have to stop dreaming about our family and settle for being a part of a family of convenience. As we approach the house, the rest of the family comes out to greet us, not with smiles, but with cold stares. Small, but I guess strong enough to help us out around the house, the mother says to the father. My face flushes with anger, but I contain myself. She motions for us to follow her inside the hut. Their hut is bigger than many we have seen, yet built like all the others. My family lives on this side, so you three sleep in that corner over there. She points to the far corner of the hut. Drop your things there. One afternoon, after a day in the forest gathering firewood, Chu and I come home to find Kim in the corner of the hut, watching the mother go through our things. I climb the steps and sit by him, holding in my anger. I cannot believe this, the mother squeals, her fingers picking up Ma's shirt. It was Ma's favorite silk shirt. She wore it many times in Phnom Penh. When the soldiers burned our clothes, Ma was wearing this shirt underneath a plain black shirt and was able to hide it from them. She risked everything just to keep it. As if she knew of her impending fate, Ma gave Kim the backpack with her jewelry sewn in the straps, as well as her favorite shirt, on his last visit to her. It is so soft, the mother exclaims happily, and slips the shirt over her head. It falls smoothly over her body,
the blue silk shining beautifully in the sun. Keen's jaw bulges as he grits his teeth, and Chu looks elsewhere. Our anger rises, but we say nothing. Finally sensing our glares, she takes the shirt off and throws it back in the bag. I don't like it anyway. It's ugly now that I really look at it. How can anyone wear this color? She says and walks away. Keem takes the shirt out and gently folds it neatly before putting it back in the bag. The only bright spot in the family is Bof, the 14-year-old brother who is very nice to me. He often takes me fishing and swimming with him and introduces me to people as his new sister. I like him. It is nice to be treated kindly. I know he likes me. He says as much. Yet at times there is something about him that gnaws at me. The odd ways I catch him looking at me, his eyes lingering too long over my face and body, makes my stomach queasy. While picking firewood in the forest one day, someone comes up from behind me and grabs my waist. I swing around ready to attack, but stop when I realize it is Bof. The clouds darken and follow above us. He walks toward me, his hand sliding on my flat chest around to my back, pulling me close to him in a tight grip. He breathes heavily, his wet lips on my cheek. In a surge of anger, I slap him across the face and push him away. "Leave me alone! Get away from me!" I scream into his face.
"What's the problem? Am I not nice to you? You like me. I know you do."
He smirks and approaches me again. I want to rip his lips off his face.
"Get away or I'll tell on you."
"All right," he says, and his eyes glare at me. "Who will believe you? It's your fault anyway, always tagging along and going places with me."
Spitting at his feet, I turn and run away. Bof is right. I cannot fight him. I cannot tell anyone, not even Keem and Chu. There is nothing I can do but keep away from him. I do not want to cause trouble with our new family. I do not want to live on the streets again. I avoid Bof after that. Wherever he is, I am not. Whichever direction he goes, I go the opposite. And with each passing day, my heart blackens with hatred for him, but I keep it all inside. I keep it well hidden as Bof laughs and goes fishing with Keem. The arrangement with the family works well for me since I am used to long hours of labor. But no matter how hard we work, they let us know we are never efficient enough. To make matters worse, the mother often wonders out loud in front of us whether we are worth our keep. We know very little about the family and dare not ask them questions. Though we all live now in the newly liberated zone, after almost 4 years of living with secrets, it is hard to change. We do not know whether they were supporters of Khmer Rouge or if they were base people. Even if the family doesn't love us, they do feed us a sufficient amount of rice, fish that the boys catch in the river, and vegetables from the garden. The family has many 50-pound sackcloth bags of rice hidden in their corner of the hut. I don't know how they got them. Each morning we set off, always the three of us, Chu, our girlfriend Pity, and I. Pity is Chu's age, and, like Chu, is rather meek and not much of a speaker. Soldiers took her father away, too, so now she lives with her mom and older brother. We first met Pity while gathering water by the stream. We watched her fold her scarf and place it on her head. She was our size, with pretty brown eyes and skin. She still wore the black Khmer Rouge pajama shirt and pants, but her hair was growing out of the blunt Khmer Rouge cut. She struggled to lift her clay water jug on her shoulders. Chu walked over to help her. From then on, she was our friend. Though she lives on the other side of town, she often meets us to gather firewood. I don't mind the task, but I hate having to roam around the woods barefoot. I am wary of snakes. The ground is covered with leaves and branches, so I cannot see what's slithering beneath them. Once, I stepped on something that at first looked like a small brown stick, but then the stick wriggled, squirmed, and slid away. The sole of my foot tickled, sending shivers all over my body. At sunrise, Chu and I greet Pity at our meeting place on the road. The haze is pink today. I rub my eyes, yawn, and adjust the ropes we brought to tie the wood, slinging them over my shoulders. Cradling an axe in her arms, Chu glowers at me for forgetting the canteen. Side by side, we walk into the woods, far away from the displaced people's camp. As I collect fist-sized dry tree branches, Chu bends and shaves the leaves with her axe. As the sun climbs higher in the cloudless sky, we take a break and rest under a tree. But it is February, and the weather is hot and sticky, even in the tree's shade. It cools only at night. I need water. My throat is burning, I complain loudly to the girls.
Me too, Pity echoes in agreement. But we can't leave now. We'll all be in trouble if we don't bring home enough firewood.
Shh, I interrupt Pity, and listen to leaves rustling nearby. Someone's coming. Looking up, we are startled to see a UN soldier walking in our direction. He is tall and thin, maybe 2 feet above us, and dressed in the standard green uniform but without the rifle and grenades on him. The UN raises his canteen to his mouth and drinks from it.
Maybe he'll give us some water, I say to the girls. Let's ask him.
The girls nod. When he is close, we approach him. He stops and smiles quizzically at us.
Water. Thirsty. Drink.
I say the words loud and slow. He narrows his eyes and shakes his head. I point to his canteen, and with my hand, I mime the drinking motion. Finally, he nods and smiles with understanding. He then unscrews the top of his canteen and holds it upside down, but nothing comes out. He points to the canteen, points to me, and motions us to follow him.
He wants us to follow him to get the water, I declare proudly to the girls.
In unison, we step forward. The Yuan turns suddenly around and puts up his palm to stop us. He points to me and waves for me to follow him.
Don't worry, I'll bring enough water back for all of us, I say,
and I follow him into the woods, leaving Chu and Pity behind. The soldier takes me far away from the direction of the base, where I assume we would go for water. As he leads me farther into the woods, my heart quickens. Looking back, I try to find Chu and Pity, but cannot see them in the thick brush. The Yuan points to an area where the shrubs are high and dense, and waves for me to come to him. Standing where I am, a few feet from him, I ask, "Where water?" By now my palms are sweating with fear. He points to the bushes and motions for me to follow.
"No," I say firmly, refusing.
Breathing rapidly, I turn to run, but am stopped by his hands on my arms. He throws me hard on the ground. I fall, scraping my knees and hands on rocks and sticks. Stunned and shaken, I try to get up, but his hands are there again, pushing me down by the shoulders. I land hard on my bottom as pain shoots through my body. My eyes widen in alarm.
"Namsung! Namsung!"
He orders me to lie down in Vietnamese. I cannot understand what he says and stare up at him. In our culture, the bride finds out all there is to know between a man and woman on the night of her marriage. I do not know exactly what he wants to do, but I know that it is bad. I struggle to get up. Again he shoves me down.
"Namsung! Namsung!"
he screams at me, his white face dark and mean now, like the faces of the Khmer Rouge. I sit there, paralyzed and speechless. I am unable to get the scream out of my throat. My heart pounds. My eyes plead with him to let me go. Time slows as he unbuttons his pants and they drop to his ankles. Breathing short, shallow breaths, I scurry back in terror. His bright red underwear stands in stark contrast against his white skin. They hug him tightly and hang below his pot belly. He hooks his thumb on the waistband and pulls his underwear down. A scream claws its way to my throat, but it comes out in a whimper. He quickly squats down in front of me, one hand gripping the back of my neck, the other covering my mouth and most of my face. His nails dig into my cheeks. My eyes follow his stomach down to his penis. It is big and quivers like it's alive. My head is dizzy as I begin to hyperventilate. I shut my eyes. I have never seen a man's penis before. Babies, yes, but I never imagined it to be so different on a man. All its wrinkles and pouches, it disgusts and terrifies me. He lowers my head to the ground, and while his hand still covers my mouth, I can see my reflection in his eyes.
"Shh, shh,"
he whispers. His body inches away from me. His hand lets go of my mouth and tugs at my pants, pulls them past my hips. A scream crawls its way from my throat and explodes loudly. Shocked, he stops. He quickly looks around. I pull my pants back on and twist my body to get up. His long fingers wrap firmly around my ankles, pulling me closer and closer, one hand now on my thigh. I slide on my bottom, unable to get away. Letting out a loud, shrill cry, I squirm out of his grasp and kick to get away. "Help! Monster! Somebody help me! Monster!" I yell, as tears stream down my face and snot drips from my nose to my mouth. Dark, thunderous, powerful hatred rises in me as I scream and call him names. With a surge of anger, I twist and snap my left leg out of his grip. "I hate you!" I yell into his bewildered face as my leg crashes into his chest. His face winces in pain. He gasps for breath and lets go of my other leg. "Die! Die!" Screaming at the top of my lungs, I kick him in the groin with all of my hatred. He doubles over and falls to the ground, hollering like an injured animal. My legs push me up, and I run as fast as I can without stopping. I flee to where I left Chu and Pity, and see their figures running toward me, axes over their shoulders, faces full of worry and fear. "Luang, are you all right? I heard you scream!" Chu questions me shrilly. I nod shakily. "We were so scared for you. We thought it was strange when he took you to the woods away from the base. We kept our eyes on you, and then you disappeared." Chu is crying now. She drops her axe on the ground. "I'm never going to be that stupid again. I want to report him to the authorities," I tell her. "No, let's get out of here and go to a place where there are lots of people," Pity pleads, and drags me away by the arm. Reluctantly, I allow myself to be dragged away. Pity helps Chu wrap the rope 3 times around the pile of wood. Then they sit facing each other with the pile in the middle. Both put their feet on the wood and push, each pulling one end of the rope. When the rope is taut, Chu ties it in a double knot. She lays the axe in with the pile of wood and strings her scarf through the rope to make a handle. Once she finishes, she helps Pity with the other 2 piles. Grabbing the scarves, we pick up the wood, now the size of our bodies, and carry it horizontally on our backs. When we get close to the base, I look closely at all the soldiers, hoping to catch the monster. I want to report him, but I do not know who to report him to. With their funny round hats and uniforms, most of the soldiers look the same to me. I am not sure which one to tell my story to. I thought they were here to save us from the abuses of Pol Pot and not to hurt us. "Come on, we have to go," Pity again pleads after a few minutes. Then, from the corner of my eye, far in the distance, I think I see him. My mind swirls with rage of revenge. My heart jumps to my throat, and I take off after him. "Monster!" I yell, running. Chu and Pity call for me to stop and return, but I ignore them. I am so full of hate, I pay no attention to where I am going. Suddenly, something crunches under my foot, and pain shoots through the sole. I break into a sweat, but do not stop. I focus on him and leap on my toes in his direction. My foot throbs painfully as blood leaves a trail over the ground. Briefly, I look to see a piece of broken glass sticking out of my foot. I look down and yank the glass out, causing more blood to spurt. When I look up again, he's gone. "He's gone!" I scream when Chu and Pity catch up to me. The pain is so great now that I have to sit down. Saying nothing, Chu takes her scarf and wraps it around my foot to stop the bleeding. "Come, we have to go," she says sympathetically. "He's gone!" "Leave him behind. We have to go." I stand up